Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Almost live from the trenches of New York City, here are your middle-aged warriors, Chris Cimino and Rick Summers.
Well, welcome to show number, Chris, you told me show 90?
90, yeah.
That's good, because I can't count that high, so I'm really glad that you're keeping track, because I'm such a loser.
Nor do we want to think about 90, but hey, that means we're only 10 away from triple digits.
Wow.
That'll be something.
I can't believe, think about when we started this. It's now 2 years ago, two and a half years ago?
Yeah, 2 years plus, about
3 years,
4 months, yeah.
I mean, I just remember sitting around talking about it long before we even got it up and running. It's and everybody's got a podcast now, so why shouldn't we have one too?
That's right. Well, I'm proud of the fact that we're still doing them. You know,
I am too. And there have been some trying times, which have been hard for you, hard for me.
Yeah.
Times that I've said, "Nah, screw it, just let it go." But every time we do it, I feel a sense of, you know what? We're not reinventing the wheel. We're just a couple of guys sharing some of our life with other people who may or may not have any interest. But the thing that's been great, as far as I'm concerned, is the guests that we've had access to and some of the things that they've said along the way and that they continue to do as we all get older together.
Yeah, I mean, the whole process is not only therapeutic for us, but hopefully for those listening. But you're absolutely dead on with pointing to it's all about the guests. We've got one today that you have brought into the fold.
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't available for the interview. We're kind of doing this post. I had to have a couple of teeth ripped out of my head. But
I wanted to ask you, before we get to that even, the interview, I wanted to ask how you're doing and ripped out of my head. Doesn't really.
Yeah, it sounds kind of rough, but I've had oral surgery over. I've known this oral surgeon, Dr. Stern, in New Jersey for many, many years. He's taken out impacted wisdom teeth and other things for me and just does an amazing, amazing job. And the last time, though, they had given me some gas. So I was kind of like, hey, this is all right. No problem. So I'm sitting there and they're prepping me for this go around. And then I'm looking around and, you know, they put the little numbing thing in there at first before they're going to give you the Novocaine. And okay, where's the gas? I didn't get any gas. I didn't get anything to really to knock me out. All I had was just some Novocaine to numb the area. But to be perfectly honest, very little discomfort. It was fine. So
good job
there. But I'm sorry I missed this interview. We've got a great guest today, Stephen Manchester, who you brought to the fold. Quickly before we get to the interview, a little bit about how that happened.
Well, Valerie, our voice of God, my beautiful better half, ended up directing this film quite by mistake, but it turned out to be a life-changing event for her life. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, you and Chris really should talk to Stephen Manchester. He's the guy who wrote the film, The Thursday Night Club, which they're in the process of editing now. They shot it earlier this year up in Connecticut. And she said, you should talk to Stephen because he's a really interesting guy. And I thought, okay, yeah, whatever. Let me find out. So I read a little bit about him and he'll tell you more. But the thing that just blew me away was the fact that he served in the Persian Gulf War back in 1991. Mm-hmm. And I remember you and I have talked about this, sitting on my couch watching that war unfold. And Stephen, while in the Persian Gulf, had some epiphanies and basically came back and said, I need to do whatever it is I was meant to do. And it wasn't necessarily going to war, but it was being a writer. And he's come back and been just incredibly proficient. He's published so many books. I mean, it's in the teens, and he'll tell you more about that in a second or two.
No, I really enjoyed the interview, and I hope those waiting in the wings who are going to listen to it, because it's very insightful, and it comes from a guy that's just so genuine. He's just such a pure soul, and you can hear it in the way he describes his path to get to where he is today, and a brilliant, prolific type writer, absolutely. So we're going to get to that first. Of course, we have to pay some bills, and we do that with our sponsor, BetOnline.
Our partners at BetOnline continue to be the number one source for all your betting needs and sports info. Find all of the latest odds, news, and sports development, including this year's basketball championship finals, the Stanley Cup finals, Major League Baseball, the latest fighting news, and even next season's early NFL futures. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use our promo code BLEAB, B-L-E-A-B, to get the bonus and get into the action. Bet online, where the game starts.
All right, Chris, thank you so much. And boy, speaking of middle-aged warriors, my partner Chris actually had two teeth, I think, removed sometime this weekend. So I'm hoping he's feeling better. But the guest of the moment and the guy that we're so happy to have is a celebrated author and so many different credits that I'm going to attach to you, Steve Manchester, who is with us. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm honored to be here. I really am.
I love that Boston accent.
Yeah, I couldn't get rid of it if I tried.
You know, something makes me want to go out and get some New England clam chowder.
There you go.
Hey, awesome. Chowder head. Yeah.
Chowder.
So how are you?
I'm well. I'm very well. Thank you. Yeah. Busy. As you know, we got a bunch of different projects going on, but things are fantastic. I couldn't be happier.
Well, so my first question is, how is middle age treating you?
Actually, I think well, right? Because it's all about attitude, right? I mean, I don't have, you know, the energy that I used to have. And, you know, there's things that I question as we get along, right, on our path here. But I feel very fortunate to be here. Every day that I wake up is a good day, right? And for me, that's not a cliche. I'm just grateful to be here and still be in the game playing, right?
Well, it's funny you say it because I used to do stand-up comedy, and mm-hmm. one of the routines I used to do was making fun of advertising slogans, and the one slogan that always jumped out at me was Folgers Coffee, and their slogan is, the best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup. And I used to think, if that's the best part of waking up, it's really time for you to step back and reassess your life.
That's the truth. I love it.
So what is the best part of waking up for you at this point?
My family, first and foremost. So I'm you know, married to my wife, Paula. We have four beautiful kids. We have a new granddaughter. So that's the best part. The best part is that legacy and continue to do what I love and sharing that with my family. That's what means everything to me.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, four kids and you have from different marriages. I think you had.
Yeah. So my wife has a daughter, Carissa. It was now my daughter. And then I had two sons, Evan and Jacob. And then together, as I told you, right, we did the Brady Bunch thing. And
right, which I think is great.
And we ended up having Bella, who just turned 18, graduated from high school, and she's on her way to NYU Tisch.
Okay. So as a middle-aged warrior, what's that like?
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. So I've walked some pretty dark roads. You know, I have a background in law enforcement and the military, but it's different when it's your kids, right? So for me, if I was going to New York City from a small town in New England, I probably wouldn't be as freaked out as I am by sending my daughter. But I also know that I cannot allow my worry, right, to get in the way of her progress. And so it's just another thing you take on. You know, when I wrote that book, Dad, Rick, right, I told people.
Right, and we want to talk about that.
Yeah. So for me, though, parenthood is, I mean, that's one of the prices you pay, right, is worry, constant worry. And I don't think it ever ends. So I'm still paying, right, and I'm happy to pay, given what I get on the other end of it.
On the other side of that worry are great dividends that you get back from from having kids.
Absolutely.
And this is great fodder for you, not father. On Father's Day, but fodder for you to become a good Jewish mother as you get older.
Right, exactly. That helicopter parent.
You know, as I always say to Valerie, who we will also discuss later on the show, wonderful. I said, I'm Jewish, she's Italian. I said, the guilt is the same, but her food is so much better.
I love that.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic.
So let's explain how you and I even interconnected.
Yeah, so
which is really amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And I, again, very, very fortunate to have made that connection. So I feel, you know, super grateful for that. But so your wife Valerie ended up taking on the directorship of a film that I wrote, or a story that I wrote, you know, called The Thursday Night Club. So I wrote that story, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago. Okay. The story ended up becoming an audio drama podcast, which was really cool. They actually recorded it in a studio in, I think it was Brooklyn a few years ago. But it's one of these, you know, perennial type Christmas stories. You can download it for free, 6 episodes on Apple. But Kathleen Turner was in it. So it was a joy, you know, to be involved in that. And then my publisher contacted me, said, hey, listen, you know, we have some people that are interested in doing the film. And your wife was attached as the director. So, of course, me being on my game, I went and researched her, and I was thrilled, right, to have Valerie, you know, as the director. And then I was blessed to be able to bring my daughter down to the set in New Milford, Connecticut, and I watched Valerie and her amazing team at work. So I'll tell you, Rick, it's one thing to write, because I live in this two-dimensional world, and I'm kind of like, it's neurosis, right? I'm by myself, and I'm creating these characters. And then my daughter and I walked into hair and makeup, and the two girls that were sitting in the chair getting their stuff done, running lines. And I look at my daughter and I repeat one of the lines and she starts laughing, but I wrote them, right? So
right.
It's a thrill to be able to see, you know, somebody like your wife, Valerie, who's you know, so talented, be able to breathe life into this story and make it that three-dimensional, you know what I mean? Like what I intended with, you know, with her spin on it and all these other people that are putting their own creative twist on it. It just becomes so much more rich.
Now, the movie side is totally new to you. And what is blown me away is looking through the laundry list of things that you have written in the past 25 years. I want to talk about your military service, because I think that is key in going through this as a warrior. And we use the word so loosely. And you really were a warrior. Since we're there now, let's talk about it. Serving the Persian Gulf War back in 91. How did that happen? Is that something you would always wanted to do as a kid growing up, go into the armed forces?
Yeah. I'll tell you, Rick, I wanted to be a police officer growing up. So I hate bullies. I've always hated bullies, right? And I was fortunate to be born with some size and you know, a little bit of confidence. And I grew up with a couple of maniac brothers. So it wasn't like I was being bullied, but I hated people that preyed on, you know, folks that are weaker than them. So my aspiration as a young man was to be in law enforcement, right? And I really did. You talk about idealism, but I wanted to make that difference. And I became a cop, and I was kind of a townie cop. And then I ended up working for the prison system in Massachusetts. And in total, I served for about 10 years. But I was in the United States Army National Guard. So I trained with the regular U.S. Army. I went to military police school. You know, I kind of came up through the ranks, and I became a sergeant. In Christmas of 1990, so picture, you know, the presents have been unwrapped, you know, the eggnog's gone. And I get a call saying, hey, listen, first formation 0700. Make sure you call your people. We're going. I said, we're going where? Well, Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, and it was Operation Desert Shield at the time. So to talk about a surreal experience, fortunately, I had a lot of training. And at 23 years old, I was considered one of the old men, right, in the unit. And we went overseas, and I served for 14th MP Brigade, 7th Corps. My job, collect POWs, provide armed escorts for convoys, all like really crazy, dangerous type stuff. But when you're a young man, it's all about the adrenaline. And as I told you yesterday, Saddam Hussein swore to take us months to get to the breach from Saudi Arabia to Iraq. And it took literally minutes. And we got in there. Again, my job was to collect POWs, and there was nothing but carnage for about the first 3 days. So it's not something that you ever expect to see as a human being. You get maybe 4 or 5 months into my tour of duty, and I flipped a Humvee. I actually flipped a Humvee end over end, and I was thrown out of the driver's side, crushed the driver's roof, and I was abandoned basically for about 3 hours. If you can picture the Humvee on its roof, the antenna was buried. I could not get, you know, I had the call signs and frequencies. I could have easily called in a medevac, but I couldn't get the call out. And we sat there for about 3 hours. And I'll tell you, Rick, I'm not afraid of too many things, right, in this world. But I was actually reduced to like a five-year-old, right, that had lost his parents in the mall, right? And I'm like, there's no, you know, I'm with my platoon sergeant. He was in shock. I treated him for shock. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, we're just waiting for night to fall, and I'm going to be taken prisoner myself. And the Iraqis weren't treating us the same way we were treating them, right? But I remember standing there in the desert, the Arabian desert, and I made a promise. Not if, but when I get home,
good,
I'm going to keep, you know, I'm, you know, because life's too short, it could end at any time, I'm going to go chase my dream down. And my dream was to be a published author. And it wasn't lost on me that the rejection rate to become a published author hovers around 97%.
Yeah.
So I figured I'd be the guy in the 3% of the pool, right? And it took me many, many years. And, you know, somebody recently asked me what was the greatest thing I ever gave my kids. And I said, and I told them that I allowed them to watch me fail for many, many years until I succeeded, because I needed to show them perseverance. I needed to show them determination, right? And, yeah, you know, you can only prepare yourself and then wait for that opportunity. And it finally happened. So that's kind of a long way to answer your question. But
no, that was a great answer. And actually, I mean, you are the perfect guest to speak to our audience, as you know, we're all getting older. Right. You and I talked in prep yesterday a little bit, and I said to you jokingly, I said, yeah, men don't cry. They cry when their team gets eliminated from the playoffs. But you know, it's just an emotion that's so to hear you talk about being reduced to, I don't know, a 7-year-old kid looking for his parents in the mall while lying in the Iraqi desert. I can hear somewhere in the Persian Gulf. I can't even imagine what that was like. But to pursue your dream of writing, when did you know you wanted to write?
So my grandfather was an amazing storyteller. And, you know, because we come from the North, you know, we have our rednecks up in the North too. And I come from one of those families that I take great pride in. You know, my grandfather was the salt of the earth, but they used to call him a swamp Yankee, which is to say, you know, the guy lived out in the woods. He could do anything with his hands. It was amazing. So to honor him and pay, you know, homage, when I got into the Gulf War, my call sign was Swamp Yankee. And I remember my grandfather, Rick, like he would tell a story and you couldn't tell if it was fact or fiction. You couldn't tell if it was real, not real. It didn't even matter. All I knew is that he could make you laugh whenever he wanted to. He could make you cry. And then he taught me that words have power and they actually connect us. And I thought, wow, like how amazing is that to be able to connect other people? And, you know, so that people don't feel alone, right? They realize that there are other people in the boat with them.
What was your grandfather's history? Was he born here? Was he an immigrant?
No, he was actually born here. So he was first generation. They came from England. So it was, you know, the Manchester family. And I think at the time they took on the names of the cities that they came from, right? But I mean, I come from generations of very, you know, heavy-handed, hardworking, you know, those type of people. And I take such great pride. And I try to teach my kids, you know, we've come a long way progressively, but I don't forget the people that paved that way, right? My father paved that way. My father's father paved that way. So my name, my last name, and I've really kind of beat this into my kids. Not beat them, but you know what I'm saying? Like I never beat my kid. No, I never beat my kid. And they know how important it is that, you know, when you leave the house, your last name is Manchester, right? So you're going to represent that, because you're not just representing you. You're representing me, you're representing my father, my, you know, your grandfather, and it goes on and on. And that means something to me. And I think when I write, there's that underlying thread in my stories about that.
I heard an athlete who was interviewed, it may have been Wayne Gretzky, the other day, who said, the one thing that the veterans impressed upon me when I was a rookie, and I think he was playing for the Edmonton Oilers at the time, and this really abuts exactly what you're talking about. And he said, you can do anything you want, just do not embarrass the organization. That is, you know, that's the Manchester name, that's the Edmonton Oilers name, and that is something you always have to be conscious of.
Absolutely. Is
putting your best foot forward.
And
we don't have a lot of that right now.
No, we don't. We don't. And I think more of that needs to happen, right, where people take responsibility. I mean, I came out of the prison system after 10 years, and I ended up volunteering for about 5 years with the Department of Youth Services. And what I would tell these kids is, there's no question in my mind, everybody has a really difficult background. We all carry our weight, right, through this world. But you're either a victim or you're not. You either take responsibility or you don't. And the reason I think I have lived the life that I've lived is because I own all of it. I own the sorrow, I own the joy, I'm responsible for all of it. And I think as soon as you make that decision, and I've tried to teach my children the same way. Don't leave here and say, well, because of this person, I feel this way. No. No, it's because of you feel that way, right? So change it. You know what I mean? And it's, you know, and I think people are less accountable today, Rick, than they've ever been, in my opinion. And it's
I agree. I totally agree. Yeah. I have to ask you, and this is a very personal question. You don't have to answer.
Oh, please do.
Have you ever been in therapy?
Yes. Actually, I spent about 5 years. I was fortunate in that it was outpatient. Right. So I was able to live a quasi, quote unquote, normal life. But when I came home, I suffered tremendously from post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, I'm talking depression, severe anxiety, you know, panic attacks. And I went back in the prison system to work. And this is going to sound really bizarre, but I do want to share this with your audience. I knew that there was something so wrong with me, because the only time I felt normal is when I was in an incredibly dangerous situation. And then the racing heart and, you know what I mean, the you know, the sweaty hands, all that made sense, right? It absolutely made sense.
It's but like you were an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, I really, it's so true. But to find that peace, everybody talks about happiness. It's not about happiness. It's about peace. It's about being okay inside your skin. And I think it took me about 5 years. And I was very fortunate to find the right therapist. And I went through a few of them. I mean, this therapist, I think for a lot of people, they'll try it and then they kind of shy away from it. My answer to that is, listen, find the person that works for you. And it's really just about getting it out, right? It's poison. You have to bleed that out.
Oh, I totally believe. Yeah, it's bleeding out the infection, letting the scab heal, and then not picking at the scab, which I've been doing it since I was a little kid.
Yeah, I'm
just the worst patient. I really am. I want you to talk about how many books you've written, and one in particular, which really caught my attention, which I haven't written, but I plan on putting it on my summer list. And that is called The Menu.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, I've written 17 books in total. We have seven that were national bestsellers, 4 went to number one. And I only share that because it's a thrill to have the opportunity to be able to write the next one. So everybody asks, hey, you know, what's your best book? It's always the one I'm writing, right? Because it's about the process. But the average book for me, Rick, takes 6 to 9 months to write. And it's because I learned how to storyboard. I've become much more efficient as a writer. The Menu took me close to 10 years to write, because I needed to get it correctly. And The Menu is really about my faith. So it's not about religion. It's not, hey, are you Jewish? Are you Christian? Are you Buddhist? It's not about that. It's about, if somebody asks me what I think about the afterlife, then let me paint that in a picture for you. It took me, there's one chapter in the book, it's actually chapter 17, for whatever reason, the number 17 continues to rise for me. But chapter 17 probably took me 4 or 5 years just to get it right, because one of the characters, you know, passes away in the book. And when she opens her eyes, this is my vision of heaven, right? But the premise of the book, and it came to me, you know, these are the most random things that happen. And then you get excited about them and you go and do your thing, right? But the question is, hey, Dad, you know, what do you think happens after we die, right? So what if we took that question, turned it on its head and asked, what do you think happened before we were born? And if you thought we existed before we, like, if you think we're, you know, we're tied together for all time, who's to say that you didn't have a say in coming here? So what I did is I created this book called The Menu. And when you open up the first page, there's literally a menu. So if you pick courage, God says, well, you got to take fear too. So the protagonist has to make a decision. He decides, you know what? I'm going to take it. Finally hands the menu back, Rick, and says, you know what? I want to experience it all. I need you to pick your gender. I need you to pick your purpose. I need you to pick. He picks everything. And then he says, will I remember any of this? He said, yeah, when you come home to me, right? But this is what you chose. The only thing you need to know is that other people chose other things. And I apply that because as much as I love my wife and I adore my wife, she certainly chose some different things on her menu than I chose, right? So there's always that point where you're like, well, how would she want to, you know what I mean? Like, why is this happening? Because she's, you know, hopefully we're living in parallel for the most part, but she's on her own path. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm on my own path. So it was a joy to write it. Hospice throughout New England adopted the book. I can't even tell you how many speaking engagements, but again, not a judgmental thing. Almost like, you know, the tagline on the cover is, you are never alone, not ever. And it's not, we're not talking about dogma here or breaking down, you know, what people believe religiously. It's about, I think we're all in the same boat. I'm rowing. How about you pick up an oar, right, and row with me?
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that you talked before about wanting to be a police officer. You said, I went back into the prison system, and I actually probably should have jumped in and said, he wasn't in prison. He was working.
I was working there, yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I realized that. And we're talking with Steve Manchester, who is such an accomplished author and dialogue-tician. Okay,
right.
I make up my own.
Yeah, we'll take it.
I'm like the former president. I make up my own language.
Yeah. No, you're not like him.
It's such a joy to talk to you. And I can't wait to read this book, The Menu, because I have just, you know, I'm turning 62 next week. And my dad died 2 days before his 62nd birthday.
Oh, wow. Right.
Like a long time ago.
Right.
But I've been thinking a lot now about life and stuff, and thinking about, you know, all the things that probably are going to be placed on your menu. One from column A, two from column B.
Sure.
In case we're going to a Chinese restaurant. Just real quick, because I know we're closing in on time quickly here, but I wanted to know about your book, Dad.
So my dad passed 3 years ago. I was blessed to be in the room when he went. And I mean that. I held his hand. And
yeah.
It was one of those experiences where it was incredibly emotional. I have four siblings. One of them was upstairs in the maternity ward. My father had promised her that he wasn't going to go anywhere until the baby was born. And my nephew, Lucas, was born at 11 o'clock at night. And 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 hours later, my father passed away.
Oh, my God.
So you talk about a spiritual experience. I can literally, like, picture them, you know, tagging each other in, right? Like high five.
Yeah, really.
You
know, high five. And there's the cross home plate, right?
Right. Yeah. Bringing a new player onto the field. So when he passed, I ended up working with my publisher, Lou Aronica, who's absolutely brilliant. And he said, hey, what do you think? I'm not looking to exploit. And it's not about that. I write very emotional stuff. I'm known for writing tearjerkers, male perspective to a female audience. So I wanted to write about fatherhood, but from three different perspectives. So we have the old timer who is, you know, on his deathbed, and all he wants to do is make amends and you know, impart those last nuggets of wisdom. You have his son who is during a you know, stereotypical midlife crisis. What the hell's going on with me? You know, my career's coming to an end. My kids don't need me the way that they used to. What is my marriage like? You know, and then you have his son who finds out that he just got his girlfriend pregnant. Yeah. So very, very complex storylines, but they kind of, you know, intertwine in a way that, and it's hard to say this about your own work, but I love this book because I was able to capture three different phases of fatherhood. One that I'm yet to experience, but I've seen my father go through it very intimately. So I know I'm on my way there, right? So it's just one of those neat projects.
Can I go out on a limb?
Please do.
And include you as my part of my mishpacha.
Yes.
Which is a great Yiddish word moving forward. I mean, you are, I feel like I've known you for years, and yet this is the first time we've ever actually
seen each other. Yeah, absolutely. Talked.
But I just feel, I love your soul. I love your,
thank you, brother.
Your input, and there's so much more I want to talk to you about, and hope that we can again.
Oh, yeah.
And
next time you'll come back.
Hey. Chris is here because he's got a gazillion questions. But
I'd love to. Yeah.
Can I wish you a happy Father's Day, even though it's already passed?
Thank you. And, I appreciate that.
And that we'll do this again.
Yes.
Steve Manchester, can you just give your website so people can find your
work? Yes. So I'm at StephenManchester.com with a V. My parents couldn't afford the PH, so it's StephenManchester.com. I'm also on Facebook. I'm very active. I'm very approachable. I love working with, you know, aspiring writers, and I love, and for me, when I write a book, I write anything, Rick, right? It's the first half of a conversation, and the second half is the feedback. It's actually talking to people that read, right? So I really love that. So if, you know, if you want to reach out, friend me on Facebook, or, and all my stuff's on Amazon.
Everybody's stuff is on Amazon.
Yeah, it's the world now, right? It's, you know, 95% of the market. So
I know, really. Steve, crazy. Thank you so much for your
time.
Thank
you, Rick. Thank you.
Really,
I appreciate it.
Such a joy to talk to you. And thank you for your years of service.
Thank you, sir.
And what you continue to do for all of us.
Thank you. Rick, it was my pleasure. A joy. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, first of all, I love that Boston accent.
And yeah. You know,
just sounds like kind of a tough guy, but
he's
not. He's Mr. Sensitivity, too. I think he's all of that. He's a strong man, too, obviously, and a tough man. But, wow, the diversity in his life. What a story, right? What a wonderful story. And I'm so happy that there's more to come as he continues to write.
Me too. And I'm reading his book that we talked about before, The Menu, which I'm going to send a copy to you. And I have a funny feeling I'm going to buy a few and send them to, you know, people who are important to us in our lives. Because
sounds fascinating, that story.
Yeah, it really.
What a great concept. Really.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's I don't want to say preachy, but it certainly is spiritual.
right,
and ethereal.
To talk about life in a way that doesn't draw lines in the sand or separate us by labels of what religion or God we're following, it's kind of a little more generic.
By the way, lines in the sand is pretty good since he was in the Persian Gulf War.
Ah, see that? It's all coming good. That was subliminally done. I had no intent on that. Subliminally done. But
that's why they pay me the big bucks.
There you go. But he's had some, you know, I don't know if they were number one or certainly top sellers in the New York Times.
He's had some bestsellers. Yeah. And as I mentioned in the interview, you know, Valerie was really lucky enough to come across Stephen because her company basically got a hold of the material that they wanted to, you know, develop into a movie, which they did. And she was the director of that movie. And it's really just been a life-changing, altering experience.
Yeah, and I'm sure for him, just to see the evolution of him writing something and then a book and then to a screenplay, you know, it's that's got to be really very rewarding and really impressive. And he seems very excited about it and happy that it's in good hands. So we look forward to that as well. What else is going on with you before we say goodbye today?
Not much. I mean, you know, summer solstice. And we always joke that once July 4th comes, summer's pretty much over.
Well, you say that and Valerie says that.
Yeah.
Mine's just getting started. I feel like I haven't even started yet.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that it's the last week of June. And it's a birthday for me.
That's right. I know you don't want to think about it. But
No, I'm happy to think about it.
Okay, good. Well, we have to have some fun. We have to do something, either a lunch or a dinner.
Well, that sounds great. I'm happy to eat anything you put in front of me, and I'm hungry right now. So there you go.
An easy date. I like that.
I am an easy date. Right. And a cheap date, too, because with my MS, I don't have to drink a lot to feel, you know.
One glass of wine, and you've had a wild night of partying. Yeah, you're on.
That's basically it.
Well, we look forward to that. A pre-happy birthday, but, you know, we'll see if we get a show in after that. But, yeah, so, I mean, for the most part, I guess everybody's gearing up for summer. School's out for those who are still dealing with kids in school. I had a good Father's Day. We spent some time with the kids.
Good.
It was nice.
Good. I wanted to ask you about that.
Actually, I got, for some reason, this Father's Day, speaking of books, we had an author on, oddly enough, and my daughter got me the McCartney Lyric A to Z, which is a book that basically, it's over 150 songs that he wrote, and he explains all of the background and what, you know, how the songs survived. It's really, I just started reading the intro to the book, and it's fascinating, and there's apparently Linda Eastman, who his first wife, she kept a lot of the scraps of sheets of paper they would write things on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she has like this huge scrapbook filled with all of those things. So they go to that, and you see some of those images as well. And then
just wanted to ask you, the Chris and Edmy summer concert tour is...
Yes.
Have you finished? I know you're getting ready to travel, but the concert tour here in New York...
Let me see if I can remember.
And there's no Dave Matthews anywhere in the equation, which is crazy.
Well, yeah, it's not working out in July for me, so we'll see how it goes. But so far, no go.
You saw Billy Joel at the Garden. Don't tell me because I know McCartney out at the Meadowlands.
MetLife. It's the Meadowlands. Yeah,
MetLife.
That was the last show.
And then you saw Coldplay.
Yeah, the order was actually March was Elton John.
I forgot about that. Yeah,
there was Elton John, and then Coldplay, then Billy Joel, and then Paul McCartney. And the funniest thing about all of it with McCartney, again, the longest show, almost 3 hours. He's on that stage almost three consecutive hours. And I love Elton, love Billy. But, you know, you watch them get up from their piano stool and they kind of waddle over to the edge of the crowd and they wave and bow, you know. Paul, who's the oldest, he just turned 80 the Saturday after that show, and he's bouncing around, climbing up steps to go to the next level of the stage. I don't know how this guy does it, and it was phenomenal. Springsteen came out, did a few songs, and even John Bon Jovi came out to sing Happy Birthday to him with some balloons. So it was a very festive night, always a great show. So it was ironic that my daughter got me that book. So, you know, it's the Beatles are kind of one of those things you walk away from for a few years, and then all of a sudden you start getting into them again, and you listen to them and hear them in a different way. And whether it's through the evolution of your own life, your perception changes to what you're hearing. And the other thing, actually, real quick, my son got me another book. This is an interesting one. The Man Who Broke Capitalism. That is Jack Welch. It's a very it's your former boss. My former boss, and it's a really tough book about Jack Welch. It's not, it doesn't shine a lot of sunshine on him, let's put it that way. So it's really an interesting read.
Now we just have to teach you how to read.
Well, that's got to, you know, I go, there are no pictures, and this is the problem with these books. So I'm working on that, but anyway, so I thank my children for a really wonderful Father's Day. It's always great to spend time, you know, and hear laughter and share that with anybody, friends or family for that matter. So
you work on your books. I'm going to work on my Stephen Manchester, The Menu.
Yep.
We'll compare notes, and we have a couple of shows that we're toying with moving forward, including one concerning finance and what you should be doing with your money right now. Yeah. Also, speaking of the Beatles, May Pang, has a documentary forthcoming. It's been at the Tribeca Film Festival, has been gracious enough to agree to come on and join us for Middle Age Warriors. So
we're going to do that
sometime this summer. Yeah. I've known May off and on through the years, and she's a doll, and her stories, you know, the stuff that documentaries are made of.
There you go. Oddly enough, she's doing one. Well, we wish her luck with that, and we hope to get her on the show as well. And yeah, I think we have a lot of nervous Nellies right now, including yours truly, in terms of finances and where this is all going, with interest rates going up and 401k plans shrinking and et cetera, et cetera. So we hope to get one of the guests that we've had that's been an expert on it, at least in the past, to get back on the show and talk about that shortly.
Yeah.
So for me, sunshine always. Stay smart, stay safe, stay wherever you want to stay out there, but just stay, okay? That's all we ask.
Stay just a little bit longer.
Stay free.
Anyway, be good, feel good. I'm Rick. He's Chris. We so thank you for checking out Middle Age Warriors, and hope your summer solstice is wonderful.
I like it. I'll drink to that. And remember, the show is always brought to you by Bet Online. Go Mets.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.